when we started our discussion of romantic music, I said that music was especially valuable for romantics because it dealt with the ineffable, that which was too concrete for words, to use Felix Mendelssohn's expression. You'll have noted the irony then that we began our discussion of romantic music with song, of course, a musical form especially bound up with words. That's what it is. It's now time that we turn away from that and talk about what romantics did when they were, in some sense, not tethered to words. However, romantics often were tethered to words. They found that combination of music and poetry to be especially useful, so that it is harder than you might imagine to find illustrations. One of these comes in the form of this Chopin etude that we studied in preparation for today. Indeed, both of the pieces you studied for today are etudes. Now, etude as a musical form is one that you'll know if you ever had to suffer through music lessons as a child, right? The etude is the kind of piece that we write for our little students to play, right? This little exercise to help them practice their scales or understand arpeggios or kind of understand how chords line up against each other. That's what an etude is. Notice the intentional, and I think we can say almost ironic, unassuming nature of the genre. This idea of saying, oh, it's just a little etude. This thing I wrote in my free time, don't take it too seriously. Please, please, please don't judge it in comparison to 30-minute long piano sonatas by Beethoven, because that would not be good for me, right? That's the way romantics work when it comes to piano music. They often write these pieces in these sort of unassuming genres. The impromptu becomes a genre, right? This thing that we just sort of played off the top of our head. The prelude becomes a genre in the 19th century. That is to say, this thing that we make in preparation for something else, a prelude to nothing, right? There's no follow-up, right? An intermezzo becomes a genre in the 19th century. This thing we play in between other things. So all these things develop as a way of avoiding hard and fast comparisons to bigger, more substantial, more consequential works. Part of this is still a turn to the lyric form, an evasion of the massive dramatic works of the classical era. And at the same time, I don't think any of you would have been under the assumption that the etudes we studied in preparation for today were sort of children's pieces, right? It's kind of unassuming. They were both very consequential in very different ways, And I want to begin by talking about this etude by Chopin, an etude in E major, and it comes from his Opus 10 etudes, a bundle of etudes that he published as a single event. And this is the third from that publication, E major etude from Chopin's Opus 10 etudes, the third of that opus number. Its form is turning, a three-part form. But that is not the heart of the matter. I mean, the heart of the matter is what happens in the opening A section, where we have this tentative melody that eventually gains momentum as it gains a clear sense of goal or telos. It achieves that goal, it achieves that climax, and then outstrips it. And having outstrips it, it's not sure what to do next. It reaches its climax, and then it's not sure where to go. Let me play that for you, just that opening A section, and we'll talk about it for a second. This is the opening of Friedrich Chopin's Opus 10, number 3, an etude in E major. Thank you. once the A section ends. Now, is that not like Friedrich's Wanderer, right? Who climbs and reaches his summit? And then what does he get for his efforts? It's not clear where to go next. Now, this is a central romantic problem. Romantic music is often like this, even at its happiest, where it proposes a kind of obvious sort of place to go and then achieves that rather early on. But then what next? To quote Sarah Teasdale, the heart asks more than life can give. When that is known, then all is known. Waves break fold on jeweled fold, but beauty itself is fugitive and will not hurt us when we're old. Well, such is the common romantic attitude that they're actually most frustrated when they're most satisfied, when all the things fall into place and they discover that the longing that they've had, which is temporarily satisfied in this life, seems to only suggest a further longing which this life cannot satisfy. Let me put this into terms that will be immediately clear to you. You remember when you were a child and you came down on Christmas morning, perhaps the best Christmas morning of your memory, when you came down and all the presents were under the tree, and all the things that you'd hoped for months and perhaps even years, there appeared before your little eyes, and you opened present after present and discovered all the things that you had wanted are absolutely there, and it's complete. Describe then your attitude 2 hours later. Tremendous disappointment, unsubstantiated, unclear why, right? But the sense of, it's not as good as I thought it was. It's not as good as I thought it would be, right? Hope after hope seems to yield this sense of longing after longing. And such is life again and again. In some years now, while you graduate, you'll have in your hand a diploma. And before it's even cold from the press, you will think, huh, now what? And you'll get a job and think, this is great. I've got a living, maybe get a mortgage, get a house, get married, have a family. This will be so fun. And then you'll think, now what? What is this all driving at? What's happening next? And again, romantics face this question. So what does Chopin do with this question? Well, he goes a roving, he goes a wandering, right? It's like that old wailing song. We'll spend all our money on the Spanish girls ashore, and when it's all gone, we'll go wailing for more. We'll just do it again, right? Just run right out and do it again. So it's just the B section of this piece. It goes a roving, right? You'll notice him exploring one idea, and then it turns sour, it turns minor. So he tries it, something else, and then he goes back to the original, and it turns sour, it turns minor. And then there's this tremendous collapse as he discovers that there is nothing else. There is nothing else to do. Well, we'll see what he does with that discovery when we get there. But here's our B section. New thing. Again. That didn't go anywhere. Higher. Higher. All right, never mind. We'll try this. And it goes minor. Never mind. We'll try this. Wait, what was that other thing again? No, it goes minor. It goes minor every time. Oh. Thank you. how it ends. What many of us know that if this life offers only tentative satisfaction that seems to yield in measure only greater longing, then surely that is proof that we're not made for this life, that we're made for another one, for the land of the living, where longing is ultimately satisfied. And I think in some measure Romantics understood this, and yet did not entirely capitulate to it. Questions about that? Well, our other etude for today is a very different sort of thing. I mean, it's much more flamboyant, much harder to play, and I suppose in that sense is much more like an etude in that it teaches a technique of sorts. But we have to understand that almost all very difficult 19th century music has its difficulty because of an appeal to a particular intellectual concept which dominated 19th century composition, which we might describe as virtuosity. This idea that musical pieces that are especially hard might offer us an opportunity to transcend by our very technique human limitations. This explains why Liszt wrote a set of etudes which he called transcendental etudes. Etudes that were so hard that you needed to transcend human ability simply to play them was the idea, right? This does connect very nicely to concepts that develop in the 19th century, the concept of the Superman. Had not developed at this point, but eventually would. This idea that what's the next iteration of human beings, right? What's the next, what's human being 2.0 going to be like? Well, one way to urge toward that is to sit in the practice room for 6 years, as Liszt did, and come out the greatest pianist of all times. To be able to play pieces like this requires almost Herculean ability. That you're able to transcend technique hitherto. And it certainly is a very hard piece to play, as I'm told. I mean, I certainly have never tried it and have no intentions on ever trying it, but one of our students here, Daniel Herbner, played it in a recital not too long ago, and it was a thing to hear. It was pretty amazing. So Liszt wrote a set of these. I mean, Liszt was the guy that brought the piano into the concert hall to turn it away from a parlor instrument into a concert instrument. He was capitalizing on some of the technological improvements of the instrument during his own age. We moved from a wood frame instrument, which could support a very limited range, to a steel framed instrument, which could support 88 keys, and certainly some 19th century pianos had even more than that, even bigger key ranges than that. It allowed for a much larger sound, much larger instrument, and Liszt capitalized on this. And he was the guy to do it. He was a tall, handsome man, beautiful hair, you know, big hands, and he was able to play in a kind of a way that would turn the piano into almost an orchestral instrument. But don't ever take this as mere flash, as mere showing off. It's bigger. It's always a sense of straining toward what we might be able to do next, a kind of progression of technique into the harder and still harder pieces until finally we had come out the other side into humanity 2.0, the Übermensch, the great Superman that comes out on the other side of this. This particular transcendental etude, the transcendental etude in D minor, carries with it a subtitle, which is obviously very pointed. The subtitle is Mazeppa. Mazeppa, not a household name today, but he was a very famous character in folk culture in the 19th century, particularly among Romantics. To give you a sense for this, Theodore Jellicoe painted a Mazeppa. Victor Hugo wrote a poem about Mazeppa, so did Lord Byron. Tchaikovsky writes a piece about Mazeppa. So I should probably tell you a little bit about Mazeppa. Mazeppa was a squire to a knight, that is to say, he's, you know, the armor bearer to a knight, a Ukrainian knight, a Cossack chieftain. And Mazeppa was a very good squire to his knight. He was very faithful. He was faithful in practically every way, all but one way. He was in love with his knight's wife, and he managed to woo her and win her away from her husband, so that Mazeppa and his knight's wife indulged in a protracted affair. And as these things go, they were eventually discovered, and discovered at some tremendous shame. Mazeppa was punished by his knight and his knight's entourage in a very fiendish way. Mazeppa was stripped naked and then tied back to back to a wild Ukrainian horse. And the horse was whipped and lashed and sent back out into the wilderness on a 3-day-long ride until the horse eventually dashed itself to death. Mazeppa nearly died in the affair, but then at the very last was resurrected by a peasant woman, restored to life, and then he eventually brought vengeance on his own master by raising up a peasant overthrow of the castle. This is, of course, an immoral story. Its hero is the guy who's doing wrong and doesn't get his just deserts in the end, but heroically triumphs over his enemy. 19th century people loved this story nevertheless, and I think they loved it because it was kind of a picture of great struggle in the face of love, of great suffering, and then overcoming great suffering. So it becomes a helpful topic for Liszt here in this piano piece, and I think we're going to hear how very pictorial this piece actually is. Again, I've drifted away from absolute music to music that's sort of about words, but such is the case in the 19th century. They have this tentative relationship on that front. To give you a sense of the poem, I could have turned to Victor Hugo's poem, Mazeppa, but it's in French, and I don't want to have to work from a translation. So I'm going to read you a couple of quick passages from Lord Byron's version, and I think that's germane because Hugo himself was reading Byron's version, and in fact we meet as the superscript of Victor Hugo's poem, a line from Byron's poem. Liszt was working from Hugo's poem, but probably knew Byron too, because Liszt would read, you know, everything. So let me read just two cantos. One, the ninth canto, when the horse, which was to be the seat of torture for Mazeppa for 3 days, was first brought to him. Bring forth the horse. The horse was brought. In truth, he was a noble steed, a Tartar of the Ukrainian breed, who looked as though the speed of thought were in his limbs. But he was wild, wild as the wild deer, and untaught, with spur and bridle undefiled. 'Twas but a day he had been caught, and snorting with erected mane, and struggling fiercely, but in vain, in the full foam of wrath and dread, to me the desert born was led. They bound me on, that menial throng, upon his back with many a thong, then loosed him with a sudden lash. Away, away, and on we dash, torrents less rapid and less rash. And then at the end, after the horse has died, Mazeppa's still chained to his back, thinking about death, and then eventually basically dying here in the 18th canto. The sun was sinking, still I lay, chained to the chill and stiffening steed. I thought to mingle there our clay, and my dim eyes of death hath need. No hope arose of being free. I cast my last look up the sky, and there, between me and the sun, I saw the expecting raven fly, who scarce would wait till both should die ere his repast begun. He flew and perched and flew once more, and each time nearer than before. I saw his wing through twilight flit, and once so near me he alit, I could have smote, but lacked the strength. The slight motion of my hand, the feeble scratching of the sand, the exerted throat's faint struggling noise, which scarcely could be called a voice. Together, scare them all at length. I know no more. My latest dream is something of a lovely star, which fixed my dull eyes from afar, and went and came with wandering beam, and of the cold, dull, swimming, dense sensation of recurring sense, and then subsiding back to death, and then again a little breath, a little thrill, a short suspense, an icy sickness curdling o'er my heart and sparks across my brain, a gasp, a throb, a start of pain, a sigh, and nothing more. Of course, Mazeppa doesn't die. It sounds like he's dying, right? The light at the end of the tunnel. He doesn't die. In fact, he's revived. And we're going to see that at the end of our piece. Now, happily, this etude also bears a sort of ternary form. But in addition to that, a kind of theme and variations. So that we get six iterations of this theme. The first two are in minor. The second two in major. And the last two in minor again, followed by an extended coda where we, I think, hear depicted for us in a kind of almost crude way the horse dying, and then I think the bird, Ugo's wazoo, coming down and being brushed away, and coming down and being brushed away, and then coming down and then not being brushed away. And then finally, big resurrection at the end, big D major fanfare, jazz fingers, can-canny, you know, thing ends. So, away, away, and on we dash. Torrents less rapid and less rash. I'm to understand that this is a very hard piece to play. Because in both Hugo's poem and in Byron's poem, the horse makes its way through the forest and out on the Ukrainian steppes, out essentially in the desert. And so we're under the stars, and we got a major mode. There's a twinkling in the right hand. So I think this is pretty clear what Liszt is sort of depicting here. But then think about what that means. Imagine chained to the back of a wild Ukrainian steed after maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 hours of being on his back, and finding your way out under the stars, and your thought at that point is, oh, how beautiful the heavens are, right? heavens above, how beautiful they are, right? That even in our suffering, we might realize that there's something bigger than ourselves out there, something more beautiful than any of this, that almost baptizes this experience and makes it somehow okay, right? Well, it doesn't stay okay. It's just the B section. We're going to go back to the A section, right? Here we go. Third time through. Texture changes and it's much thinner. We hear what I think has to be understood as kind of funeral bells, the death knell for the horse, probably. Bum bum ba bum, we'll get, right? Which is just the opening phrase of bum bum ba bum bum ba bum ba bum ba bum. And then this very sparse melodic idea that, I don't know, it's descending. So it sounds to me like that picture of that bird coming down a couple times, gets brushed away. And then ultimately a kind of silence. But then resurrection, which is pretty neat. Brushed away. pushing it away at this point. Again, transcending the kind of thing which normally binds us. Questions about Liszt's transcendental etude in D minor, etc.